You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, since Scandinavian immigrants settled in Wisconsin over 100 years ago, Nordic culture has had a big influence on our state. For this week's Food Friday, we'll learn about Northern European food culture with the author of The Nordic Cookbook.
Last month, the world took notice when scientists discovered a strange flickering star with a unique and unnatural light curve. It was suggested that it could be an alien structure causing that flickering. But an interesting part of the story is that the star wouldn't have been found if not for the work of a citizen science project called Planet Hunters. Joining us to talk about the group is its founder, Deborah Fisher, professor of astronomy at Yale University. Deborah, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, let's talk about Planet Hunters. How did it get started?
Planet Hunters is a project that I started in 2010 with a colleague, Chris Lintott, who's at Oxford University. Chris had already started several what he called Zooniverse projects, and these were meant to be citizen science projects that engage the public in doing actual research. They're not educational outreach. It's really, you know, having the public help us with research. And we thought for a long time about what the public might do, how they might contribute to planet hunting. And as soon as I saw the NASA Kepler mission data come down in such incredible, enormous quantities, we realized that this is the project that we should have people look at and help us try to find planets that transit or cross in front of their host stars.
About this Kepler project, you said the data came down. So how did the Planet Hunters get involved? What did they do?
So the Planet Hunters, people go and sign up at planethunters.org, and they are shown light curves. So a light curve is the brightness of one of the 155,000 stars in the Kepler field. We show you the brightness of the star over a 30-day interval. And you might imagine a lot of stars are just constant, so their brightness isn't changing very much. Those are boring, and the user will click no transit seen. Other stars will have spots rotating on their surface, and they will get brighter or dimmer as those spots rotate in and out of view. And so those are interesting systems because it's harder for the mathematical algorithms to find transits there. So the users ask to look at the light curve, and the big slow variations are never going to be transiting planets. But if people see a dip in the brightness that lasts for typically a few hours, then they're asked to just click on that decrease in brightness. And that will go into our database, and we will then follow up and try and see if that's a real transiting planet.
So are these volunteers looking at the night sky with a telescope, or are they looking at a computer screen?
They're looking at a computer screen. They're looking at data that's been beamed down from the Kepler spacecraft. Kepler was launched in March of 2009. It's now in an Earth-trailing orbit. And for the first 4 years of its life, it looked constantly at one field in the sky just above the plane of the Milky Way galaxy. And so it collected unblinkingly, if that's a word, light measurements, brightness measurements for 155,000 stars. And every 30 minutes it would take one measurement, and every month it would send down the accumulated measurements that it took.
And what was this discovery like? This must have been incredibly exciting for the people who saw this. Really, something wasn't maybe what they expected.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Planet Hunters have been incredibly successful at finding planets. And in one case, I remember, I totally blew it. They found a planet going around two stars that orbited each other. It was a very bizarre system. And this time, you know, we looked at this light curve. The Planet Hunters had flagged it as something that was just really unusual and that they didn't understand. And we looked at it, and we didn't understand it either. What we saw was that about 4 years ago, the star dimmed in brightness by almost 20%. So it's hard to imagine how a star can do that, just suddenly drop its brightness, unless there's something big that's going in front of it and blocking out the brightness. And so that lasted for a while, and then the brightness came right back up to the normal levels and sort of stayed there for about 2 years. And then about a year and a half ago, we saw another drop in the brightness of the star. But this time, it didn't look at all the same. It was a series of sort of rapid drops and then brightening increases again in the light curve of the star. And that lasted over several days. And so we sort of asked ourselves, you know, why is this one star different from the other 155,000 stars in the Kepler field? And we were just absolutely stumped. We talked to our friends, our colleagues, people on the Kepler team, and no one could come up with an answer. So we decided to just publish the results with all of the analysis that we had done and, you know, just say, look, we've come up empty-handed. Here are a few ideas. There could be a swarm of comets that are going around orbiting around the star, but that's hard to understand because the brightness dip is so enormous. So we're just stumped, and we hope that you all can come up with interesting ideas. And one of our colleagues, Jason Wright at Penn State, said, you know, it's a crazy, crazy idea, but, you know, maybe there's a sort of alien megastructure that's being built around the star by a technological civilization. And we kind of all laughed about that and thought it was a funny idea. And still, it's the explanation of last resort. There's no indication that it's actually an alien megastructure, but, you know, it's a hypothesis. And so now we're setting about just trying to rule out that hypothesis or understand that.
And so these citizen scientists have been able to take part in what scientists, I'm sure, agree to is the most exciting part, new discoveries, and being part of that eureka moment. It must be, as you described it, a pretty incredible time.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think where the public has succeeded is in finding things that are really weird, because the scientists at NASA working on the Kepler mission are incredibly smart, and they thought really hard about what their computer algorithms should look for. And so they're finding the things that they trained their computer algorithms to find. But what people can bring to this is just a pattern recognition of the human brain to say, wait, that looks weird, you know, that, and it might not fit any of the algorithms that were developed to look for these things. So we're finding a lot of interesting, unusual objects, lots of thousands, really, of planets, transiting planets, including planets that orbit at great distances from their host star. We really like those worlds because those are at a distance where, you know, if there's a rocky surface on the planet, then liquid water might pool, and it might be an interesting environment for life.
We're talking with Deborah Fisher right now, professor of astronomy at Yale University and the founder of the citizen science group Planet Hunters, which recently found an intriguing new planet. And Deborah, what's next as far as trying to figure out what the truth is about this new planet that was discovered?
Well, for this one, the SETI team, the team Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has an array of telescopes in California, and they've already turned these telescopes to look at the star and to try and collect radio wavelength measurements. And so far, the star has been silent. It hasn't revealed anything. But if these are episodic events, you know, that only occur as whatever it is, a broken up planet, comets, or an alien megastructure, if they only orbit around every couple of years, we're going to have to wait another year or so before we see it again. So we have a campaign that's lined up with astronomers all around the world, including amateur astronomers, to keep observing the star and to report if they see anything unusual.
Now, of course, this discovery, this star, K1K or KIK-846, has gotten a lot of attention, but what else have Planet Hunters been able to find?
I think my favorite discovery was when we launched the site in 2010, and it was November or December of 2010, and 4 months later, my postdoc, then Meg Schwamm, came and said, you know, Deborah, the Planet Hunters have found this really weird light curve, and they've drawn a picture of it, and it looks like there are two stars that orbit each other in just a few days, but then they think they see a planet in an orbit that's about 200 days, you know, going outside of the two-star system. And what it would look like if you stood on that planet, you know, is in the daytime when the stars are up, you would have two suns in your sky. It would be really remarkable. And at the time, we hadn't found anything like this, and it seemed like a very long shot. And I remember sort of putting that, you know, on the pile of interesting things in my desk, which is sort of a big pile. And then in September of that year, so about 5 months later, NASA announced this as the discovery of a planet orbiting two stars, and they nicknamed the planet Tatooine, which comes from Star Wars. And that's a planet where, indeed, Luke Skywalker has two suns in his sky. So it was very aptly named. And I went back and found, geez, they did find it. So they found many unusual objects that have helped the Kepler team to tune up their pipelines, their computer algorithms to search more cleverly. And just things like this strange star, we're calling it Tabby's star after my postdoc, who's led the effort, that we still don't understand.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much. It's intriguing stuff.
Oh, my pleasure.
That was Deborah Fisher, professor of astronomy at Yale University and founder of the citizen science group Planet Hunters.
It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We're talking about Wisconsin's road funding efforts today. State GOP leaders have said they're serious about finding a long-term fix for our roads.
Last week, the state's Joint Finance Committee approved a $350 million borrowing plan in order to reduce delays on a number of major highway projects, but not everybody was on board.
All Senate Republicans on the committee voted against the borrowing, and now options like toll roads, gas tax increases, and vehicle registration fee hikes are being considered as long-term solutions.
Joining us now to talk more about the importance of finding a solution is John Nygren, Republican State Representative from Marinette. Representative Nygren, thank you so much for joining us.
It's good to be with you.
Well, as we mentioned, the Joint Finance Committee just approved borrowing for road projects. Why is finding a long-term solution important to you right now?
Well, I mean, you begin to look at what our debt ratio is, the amount of our dollars that we're taking into transportation fund that are going to debt service, while our borrowing in this budget was actually the lowest since 1987-89 budget. From a transportation perspective, you're beginning to see about 21 cents of every dollar that's taken into the transportation fund that's going for debt service. So long term, we need to be able to, grow our transportation fund revenues with cars becoming more fuel efficient. We're not seeing the growth in the gas tax that we had seen in the past, so it is important for us to look at different ways, new ways, to be able to assure that we're going to have a transportation infrastructure that's going to be safe and driving our economy, not just now, but, in the future as well.
Now, you've gone out on a bit of a limb and said that you're in favor of a few things that have been controversial in the past, including exploring raising the gas tax, tolls in Wisconsin, and raising vehicle registration fees. Now, your co-chair, Alberta Darling, is waiting to say what she thinks about this. Why did you decide to be upfront and let the public know what you're thinking?
Well, actually, I was in favor of looking at some of those options back even in the budget. If you remember back to the end of the budget negotiation process, there was a stalemate for about 5 weeks, and the main reason that was is because there was more willingness on the part of the Assembly to look at long-term funding solutions than there was on the Senate side, and also the governor was not there. So over that five-week period of time, we weren't able to come up with any type of agreement, so we ended up, looking at how we could fund the projects that are in front of us today. But I am not interested in, just continuing to keep the status quo, realizing that that amount of the debt service is going to continue to grow. We need to address this issue. We either need to address the issue or we need to come to a decision that we're not going to continue to fund transportation at the level that we've come to expect.
Now, one of the things you said you're in support of, looking at raising the gas tax. The governor, Governor Walker, said that he's opposed to raising the gas tax unless it gets balanced out somewhere else, those cuts. So do you expect to work with the governor on this one, and do you expect that he might cooperate with this idea?
Well, I think we're going to have to work with the governor. I mean, the reason I'd come out today or when last week and begin to talk about this is because I think the expectation was that we were going to see some solutions proposed in this budget, in the budget that we passed back in July for funding. That didn't materialize, and I'm not going to sit and wait to next until a year and a half from now when the next budget is proposed to see whether there's going to be a solution. I think we need to begin talking about it now. We need to be having these conversations not just at the state level but at the local level. And when I say local, I'm talking about with our constituents. They need to understand that we have transportation infrastructure needs moving forward and have them be part of the discussion as well. My state to my neighbor, I'm sitting in Marinette right now, just across the river, they proposed some significant gas tax, I believe, passed last week of 7 cents, but they had actually went to a referendum back this past summer, a referendum that failed, actually about 70-30, actually failed. That's not my desire, is to have a decision that's against what the will of the people is. So I think we need to have this discussion with the people back in our home districts, beginning as soon as possible, so that when we do come to a new legislative session, a new budget, that we actually have some buy-in and we can actually pass some things that the people will support.
And what about your fellow Republicans in the Senate? Do you expect them to be on board with this, especially if there is a public support behind it?
I do. I mean, I think the reason, the Senate is not against looking for a solution. I believe they are. I mean, they weren't willing to necessarily in the budget to hold up the budget at that point in time to find the solution then. But the main reason I believe the senators voted no against the borrowing plan last week was because of the desire to find a long-term plan. But, if you also remember back to the budget, my concern was here we're spending millions over the last several budgets, nearly probably $1 billion in Southeast Wisconsin's new interchange, Marquette interchange, and that's been funded. But we wanted to make sure that the project outstate were equally as important. I wasn't willing to say that the project in Appleton, projects in Appleton or projects in Madison or projects in Superior aren't as important as the projects in Southeast Wisconsin. So that's why I believe the bonding was an appropriate decision for us last week. But I do believe long-term my Senate colleagues are going to be there with us.
We're talking right now with John Nygren, Republican State Representative from Marinette, talking about the importance to him of finding a solution to road funding issues in Wisconsin. And let's look at the issue of tolls. This is something, again, that you've recently said that you would be willing to consider in terms of shoring up roads in Wisconsin. And historically, Wisconsin has had an aversion to the idea of tolls. Do you think that that's going to change, and why do you support it now?
Well, I don't know that we've had an aversion. I mean, so back when the federal government actually has to approve the ability for Wisconsin actually to have tolls on our interstate system, and we have not had that approval. We've chosen to fund our roads in different ways over the years, but I actually believe tolling is a true user fee. I mean, it's, first of all, if you don't want to pay, you can use some of the other options available to you, the roads that are available to you. It's going to most likely be in areas where of high density, high traffic, and it's a person's option. So I think that is, I guess the question would be, should people in Superior be paying for the interstates that don't run anywhere near them? Tolls are a way to be able to get the people that are utilizing the system actually to help support the system. So I think that is something that we can take a look at. And what I've actually been saying that I'm supportive of is there's a study that we've asked for in the budget to be actually analyze whether tolling would be something that could help support our transportation infrastructure in the future. There are some steps that have to take place before that can happen. Even if the answer comes back as possible, we do need to have, as I said earlier, federal approval to be able to make that happen. Now we've had conversations pretty much every time the speaker or myself have seen Paul Ryan or my congressman Reed Ribble. They know that this is something that Wisconsin at least wants to do our due diligence on to see if it's something that can be possible in our state.
And do you think the state of Wisconsin has done enough to look and make sure that the funding that we have has been used efficiently with the maximum sort of efficiency to get the maximum bang for our buck before any of these moves that we're talking about today might take effect? Vehicle registration hikes, gas tax hikes, has enough been done?
That's a great question, and actually that's something that a lot of my colleagues have questions. We're not obviously involved in day-to-day operations of the Department of Transportation, and I have a lot of colleagues who have expressed concerns. know, over, with some of those issues over the years. Like in the past couple of budgets, we've done away with some of the bells and whistles with transportation, like the, you know, wrought iron and the stamped concrete and some of the things that drive up the cost of the project. They're not necessarily a significant percentage of the overall spending, but they are, you know, they are the niceties that you may not need to keep our roads safe. But in this past budget also, we asked for an audit of the Department of Transportation. Our audit bureau will be doing an in-depth audit to help us better understand whether we're actually utilizing those dollars that we already are spending in the best way possible. I think that is probably step one before we go on to look at whether we provide any additional revenues. We need to make sure what we're spending now is being spent appropriately.
Representative Nygren, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Have a good afternoon.
That was Representative John Nygren, Republican State Representative from Marinette, talking about the importance of finding a long-term solution to fund Wisconsin's road projects.
I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. News is next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. In the mid-19th century, immigrants from Nordic countries, meaning Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, settled in Wisconsin. Nordic culture is still visible all over the state, and an important part of any culture is food.
For this Food Friday, we're focusing in on Nordic food culture with the author of The Nordic Cookbook. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What Nordic cooking traditions does your family follow? What traditional Northern European dishes do you serve? And how has the food traditions from those countries influenced the food your family eats? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Magnus Nilsson joins us now. He's the head chef of Favikan Restaurant in Sweden and the author of The Nordic Cookbook. Magnus, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, this is a huge book, over 750 pages, and you were a little averse initially to writing about Nordic cooking because you thought, how can there really be a cookbook about that? It's too broad. What made you change your mind?
Well, I think that, like, the thing with the Nordic region is that it's a geographical construction. You know, someone sat down and decided that these countries, they belong in a region together. But it's a very big geographical area and a lot of, you know, diversity within. So it's not a homogeneous cultural region. And to me, that was kind of, you know, the reason I said no at first, and then also the reason that I actually changed into wanting to write the book, simply because most people don't even know what Nordic region, even within the region, is.
So how similar are the food cultures in Norway and Denmark and Sweden? And then also you have Iceland and Greenland and the Faroe Islands and Finland. How similar are they?
Well, they're more similar to each other within the Scandinavia, like, you know, the three countries of Sweden, Norway and Denmark, than the outlying countries, for example, Finland. And there are, like, actually no real sort of pan-Nordic dishes that are the same across the whole region. But there are things, though, that remain similar or that exist in versions across the whole region.
And you did exhaustive research for this book, and I want to quote from your introduction. It made me laugh. You said, "I realized that most of what has been published in English on Nordic and Scandinavian home cooking really sucks." That's your quote there. You were reviewing all kinds of cookbooks that were out there.
Yeah.
What's wrong with what's already out there existing on this food culture?
Well, the thing is that, like, most of the books that have been published before, they were a very comprehensive collection of recipes, and the recipes themselves might have been good, but there were no context supplied with the recipes, meaning that, you know, without prior knowledge, it was very difficult to actually understand why they made sense. Or they were just, you know, ordinary cookbooks with, you know, let's make a duck dish, and then we add lingonberries, and now it's a Swedish duck, which is not particularly representative either.
So as part of the research for this book, you surveyed people about Nordic cooking. What did you learn, and how did those results influence the book? Were there any surprises for you?
Well, I learned that the way people perceive their own food culture is often quite different from reality. We often have a romanticized version, like or idea of our own culture, that isn't actually what people practice when they cook on an everyday basis in their homes, which I thought was quite interesting.
Now, one thing you say is that you may cook verbatim what is written in the book and these recipes, and it still may turn out different than you expect. And to that end, you sort of advise in including the gram scale measurements. Tell us about why those are better.
Well, I think that they're just more exact. Because if you say that something is 182 grams, it's going to be 182 grams. If you say that something is a scant cup, that's not going to be a precise measurement. And in certain recipes, I think that it doesn't matter if you have precise measurements at all, because it's more important that you taste and feel what's right. But in other recipes, especially pastry recipes, those sort of grams in difference, they can actually make a huge impact on the end result.
And so, Magnus, you are the head chef and the owner of Favikin, one of the top-rated restaurants in the world, but you are also looking at home cooking. How do you kind of bring together that very high-level cooking and the down-home cooking?
Well, all cooking in restaurants like Favikin, it's really a reflection of the food culture in an area or in a place. But maybe elevated and passed through kind of a contemporary and very ambitious filter, but it all comes from home cooking at some level. The food we eat in very ambitious and expensive restaurants is just a different version of food culture practiced in people's homes.
Let's get to some of the food here as we talk to Magnus Nilsson, head chef of Favikin Restaurant in Sweden and the author of the Nordic Cookbook. One of those basic, apparently, meals in Nordic culture is a sandwich, and it's hard cheese, butter, and bread. Tell us about the role just sort of the basic sandwich might play.
The sandwich is actually very interesting as a cultural marker, because it's something that is one of the few things that you'll find across the whole Nordic region, though it's not the same, from one place to another. The only common denominator might be that this is a piece of bread of some kind with some kind of topping on it. And what kind of bread and what kind of topping and how it's eaten, it says a lot about the country. You can look at, for example, Denmark, which have a great tradition in open sandwiches. And Denmark as a country is a very rich agricultural region. It's also the gateway for trade between the Nordics and Europe, at least historically. And this has led to a huge richness in produce. And you can see that on the sandwiches. They're so fully laden that you can't even pick them up and eat them from your hand. You have to eat them with fork and knife from a plate, right? And then if you go, for example, to where I grew up, far up north in Sweden, up into almost at the Norwegian border, historically much poorer as a region, a sandwich even today is more likely a piece of flatbread with some butter and cheese. So it really says a lot about the history of the region.
And so part of that sandwich, it's a very simple kind of basic formula that you're putting together there, but obviously the bread is an important element of that. And you talk about there being a difference in the farther north and the more southern Nordic cuisine and what kind of bread that they tend to use.
Yeah, there is a difference, because if you look at, for example, at the loaf of bread, is a real kind of luxury item, really, because you have to eat it almost the same day that it was baked for it to be any good. So for a loaf of bread to become an everyday staple in people's homes, you really have to have bakeries, and to have bakeries, you have to have a dense population that can support them. And in the Nordics, you'll only really find that in the southern parts of Sweden and Norway and in Denmark. So that area will have a traditional loaf, for example. If you go further north, where you only really had farmlands and no cities up until quite recently, there isn't any tradition of commercial bakeries up until perhaps 100 years ago. And people bake bread maybe two or three times a year. And loaves of bread, as I said before, they're not very tasty if they're not baked on a daily basis. So instead of that, maybe you made flatbreads that could be dried and stored in big stacks and used throughout the year.
I want to talk about the recipe that you sent our way. It's a recipe for Norwegian thick salt pork pancakes. This is up right now on the Central Time website. Tell us about those pancakes.
That's a dish that you'll find being cooked quite often in Norwegian homes today, and it's a slightly thicker thin pancake, maybe 5 or 6 millimeters, quite eggy. And it's fried in a pan together with salt pork or bacon. And you use the fat that renders out of the meat itself to fry the pancake in. And it's quite often sprinkled with some chopped chives and things like that as well.
It sounds really, really delicious to me. And
it
was funny that you said earlier that people think if you add lingonberries to a recipe, it automatically makes it Swedish. But actually,
Maybe I was over-exaggerating a little bit there, but it's kind of true.
But one of the possible additions to these pancakes are actually sugared lingonberries. So what is it about the flavor combination of savory pork and sweet pancakes and lingonberries that make it work so well?
I think the lingonberry is interesting because it's quite a tart berry, and it keeps very well. It has a naturally high levels of benzoic acid in it, so it never goes moldy and never goes bad. And you can just add a little bit of sugar, and it keeps forever. So it's a very convenient thing to have on hand. So I think that's one of the reasons, you know, why it's sort of turned into an everyday staple and a condiment that all through the Nordic region is combined with different savory foods.
Here in Wisconsin, we have cranberries, which are also quite
tart. Similar.
And it does go along with a lot of things, kind of bringing out the other flavors. So I'm guessing the lingonberries would do the same.
Definitely. They are quite similar in flavor profile, lingonberries and cranberries.
You had an interesting part of the cookbook where you talked about, I guess it's pronounced fika in Sweden,
yes,
which seems to be code for little snacks throughout the day, which I think sounds like a great idea. But can you tell us about the fika or fika?
Yeah. It's a snack in between meals, basically. And quite often, it's a cup of coffee with something next to it. You know, it could be a cookie or a bun. It could be a sandwich. It could be something more substantial than that as well sometimes. And it's really kind of an institution. And you'll see in many Swedish workplaces that perhaps people start the day, you know, together sitting down for a cup of coffee and a quick snack. And, you know, in between the normal meals like lunch and dinner, you'll slip little fika moments in.
We're talking to Magnus Nilsson now about the food traditions and recipes of Scandinavia and beyond for Food Friday. He's the author of the Nordic Cookbook.
And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What's your favorite Nordic dish and what traditional Nordic foods does your family still make? Do you have any favorite Nordic recipes? If you've ever traveled to that region of the world, what was your experience with the food like? Call 800-642-1234 or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue this conversation and get to your calls in just a minute. Right now, here are a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion about Nordic food culture now with Magnus Nilsson. He's the author of the Nordic Cookbook.
We want to hear from you, too, at 800-642-1234. Share your favorite Nordic recipes with us. What Nordic foods or dishes are important to your family traditions, and will some of them show up on your holiday table? How has this region's food culture affected the way you eat? Call in at 800-642-1234. 1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our calls right now. We've got Mike joining us first in Whitewater. Mike, hi.
Hi. I was just listening to your show. It made me realize that in the last week, I ate lutefisk at a lutefisk dinner at a little Lutheran church, and I just made 15 pounds of what I grew up calling Swedish potato sausage. And then I also bought lingonberries.
So you're really having a Nordic week so far.
I'm ready for the holidays. These were always traditional holiday foods when I was growing up.
Oh.
And even now that I'm an adult that moved away from where I grew up, I still have to have them at the holidays.
What is that potato sausage, Mike? Tell me what that is.
Well, it's 10 pounds of potatoes, 3 pounds of beef, 2 pounds of pork. Everything's ground up, mixed together with some onion and some spices, and the spices vary depending on whose recipe you use. But I always had it at my grandparents' house at Christmas, and it was referred to as Swedish potato sausage. A Jewish friend of mine tasted it once and said, "Oh, it's hash." And of course it is, but he really I was so disillusioned when he said that because, you know, for me it was this really special Swedish thing we had at Christmas.
Well, that sounds great. Thank you, Mike. And Magnus, what about those foods that Mike ate, the lutefisk, the potato sausages, the lingonberries? Does that sound like some of the things that show up in your cookbook?
And definitely. And it's interesting because they're all examples of food that has been preserved to keep. You know, the lutefisk, of course, but also those potato sausages. And to make high starch content sausages is quite common, especially in central Sweden, because you can induce lactofermentation. You know, lactobacillus consuming those starches in the potato, producing lactic acid, and thereby preserving the sausage for, you know, making it possible to keep it for a really long time.
Now, Mike mentioned that different spices are used depending on who's making their Swedish sausage. And I think often when we think about the taste of a particular culture's cuisine, it's really about the spices and the seasonings. Are there some seasonings and spices that are used really consistently in Nordic culture?
I think especially in Sweden and Denmark, you can find quite a lot of sweet spices in the traditional recipes because both countries had their own East Indian companies and did a lot of trading. You know, historically. So you'll have a lot of cardamom, cinnamon, cloves, ginger, nutmeg, allspice, stuff like that.
And let's go back to the phones. And Aaron in Spring Green is up next. Hi, Aaron.
Hello.
Hi.
So while I was listening to your radio show, I, remembering back during the holidays, as the previous caller said, we would always have those traditional foods, lutefisk and lefse. And I also remember back when I was in middle school, my parents took me to Sweden, and we went to visit some relatives in Bodø, Norway. So we drove from Stockholm, Sweden to Bodø, Norway, and along the way we would stop different places to eat. And one place that I remember vividly is a church that was having, I think, a reindeer celebration, potluck. And we pretty much were eating reindeer meat. Blood sausage was one of the things that I remember eating.
Magnus, does that sound like a common dish?
Well, in certain parts, definitely. And the reindeer in Scandinavia is, they are all property of the Sami population, the semi-nomadic indigenous population of northern Scandinavia, who hold reindeer, and like large parts of their food culture is based on, you know, using pretty much everything on the reindeer.
We're talking right now for Food Friday with Magnus Nilsson, the head chef of Favikin in Sweden, and he's the author of the Nordic Cookbook. And Magnus, here in Wisconsin, we pride ourselves on our cheese. We're the cheese state, in fact. How important is cheese to Nordic cuisine?
It's actually very important. At least in the northern parts of Scandinavia, between Norway and Sweden, you can have a lot of very very good dairy culture. And it's really a part of the region which is has a food culture based on dairy and grains.
So looking at the geography of Northern Europe, Magnus, the landscape is really dominated by water, both around the coasts and in the interior as well. How does that influence Nordic food culture?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing with every cultural expression, that it's it's a consequence of the circumstances where it's practiced. And with food, that becomes very apparent, because if you live close to water, food culture, like rich fishing waters at least, food culture inevitably becomes rich in dishes based on fish. And you can see this throughout the whole Nordic region, both today and historically, like, for example, with the importance of herring, both Baltic herring from the Baltic Sea and herring from the North Atlantic.
Well, we have a caller who would like to talk about herring. Brian in Madison is on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I lived in Sweden when I was growing up, and I remember going to a party out in the country, and I rode my bicycle out there, and as I got closer and closer, I smelled something like roadkill, but it was actually, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It was actually surströmming, and if I remember correctly, it's fermented herring, and it was, I think I even had to leave because the cabin smelled so bad. It was, and I was told that if you put on enough mustard and whatever, it tempered the flavor, but it was really, really foul.
And memorable, obviously.
Yeah.
Tell us about that, Magnus, the fermented herring.
Surströmming is a dish that's unique to Sweden. And fish fermented with salt is not at all unique to that particular place, but it has been done all over the world. But what's unique to Surströmming is that it's fermented in a tin can. And that gives, you know, it's an anaerobic, an oxygen-free fermentation. So it keeps all that aroma locked up into the can. And it's really like, you know, it was invented as a way of preserving Baltic herring, you know, and transporting it to various parts of the country. And today there is obviously no such need because you can transport it fresh or you can freeze it, but still people keep this tradition alive. And especially towards the end of summer in the northern parts of Sweden, you're going to, you know, if you drive with your window open through village after village, you're going to feel the scent of Surströmming lasting through the car.
Now, last year, my husband and I bought our first Abelskiver pan without really knowing what they were, and I saw them in your cookbook today. These are these little, I guess, pancakes from Denmark. Can you tell us about Abelskivers?
So they are little donuts, basically, that you fry in a special pan with how would you describe it? Little dimples in it, perhaps. So basically, it's a puffed up pancake that's almost round. It can have different fillings, and it can also be just plain dough.
So, Magnus, you're an acclaimed chef in Sweden, so obviously you already know a lot about food, but in the process of researching this huge book and going around and eating all of this food, what did you learn in the course of writing the book?
One of the most interesting things I learned was the fact that I knew very, very little about the region I thought I knew a lot about. You know, I'm still kind of astonished about the variation and diversity of food culture within the Nordic region.
Well, Magnus, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Magnus Nilsson. He's the head chef of Favaken. It's in Sweden, and he is the author of the Nordic Cookbook. He was with us to talk about Nordic cuisine on this Food Friday.
And don't forget, his recipe for that thick salt pork pancake is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
Today is World Kindness Day. It's being billed as a 24-hour celebration dedicated to paying it forward and focusing on the good.
Organizers suggest that you share kindness quotes. Something like, "The world is full of kind people. If you can't find one, be one."
Some other suggested kindness activities are writing someone a gratitude note or donating to a charity or ordering someone flowers. Well, lots of ideas there. Are you going to do anything to celebrate World Kindness Day?
Well, you can let us know. You can share your quote and let us know if you did anything special to observe World Kindness Day over at the Central Time Facebook page. And Judith, what about you? Have you been extra kind today?
Well, I am filling in for Rob.
That's
so
very
that
kind.
That should count for something. But actually, I have a friend who's going through a rough patch, and there's not a whole lot I can do to make it easier, but I thought maybe a night out would be helpful. So I picked up a gift certificate and said, go have a meal on me.
Nice. Well, happy World Kindness Day, and I guess go out there and be kind. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll recap some of the biggest headlines from around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Life and peace.